Welcome to the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. My name is Susan Giffen, and I'm your moderator for today. Before we begin, Gordon Campbell has asked if he would be allowed to say something, and we're going to give him that opportunity.
Thank you very much, Susan. Ladies and gentlemen, in accordance with the traditions of the Council of Public Affairs, petitions and other information may be circulated as necessary in the room adjacent to this room. Not in this place where we speak and debate, but outside, which is a corridor open to the public. And it's in that sense that I ask you to consider a petition in connection with the Robert Latimer case. You know the details, and you probably made up your mind in connection with it. But this petition is being circulated throughout the city by Mr. Larson. It's in the Penny Coffee House, other places. There was a mention of it today in the newspaper, so I don't need to say anything more about it, except to say that the issue is one of compassion and one of mercy. And with all the other considerations in mind, if you wish, you may sign this petition. I'll leave it on the table just outside the door, and you can sign as you go out. We may not sign it in here, but we can sign it as you go out. Thank you for the courtesy of the time.
Just a reminder that your lunch today is $10. If you would put that in the basket on the table, assign someone at your table to count the money and assure it's the right amount, and then someone will pick it up just between after lunch. SACPA is a volunteer nonprofit organization and relies on the contributions of members and session attendees to continue its work. So if you could see fit to throw a little donation in the pot, that's always really appreciated as well. We'd like to acknowledge the University of Lethbridge, who each week distributes our flyers either through the mail or via email. The Lethbridge College Communication Arts students for recording the audio to be posted on the SACPA website. And we thank Ericsson's for the lunch that they provide us on a weekly basis. So it's, as you know, SACPA follows the format of a speaker for 25 to 30 minutes. Then we break for lunch, we chat about what the speaker has told us and all the things that we've learned, and then we come back and there's a 25-minute question and answer period. So at this time, I'd like to introduce then Scott Stenbeck. Scott has been involved with MATL. The MATL transmission line is more energy going south. Since 2004, MATL, and that's the Montana-Alberta tie line, has been trying to gain regulatory and property owner approval for a 300-megawatt high-voltage transmission line between Lethbridge, Alberta, and Great Falls, Montana. Initially, the $100 million project was to be operational by spring 2007, but EUB hearings concerning the MATL application was just recently completed. Many affected parties voiced their opinion for or against the planned power line. Routing and safety issues were among the more disputed items, and a decision is expected in early 2008. Questions that were being asked were, do we really need this line in terms of power supply? Should we be integrating our power lines east-west rather than north-south? And the MATL project is being touted as a win-win venture. The question remains, for whom? Scott is going to talk to us about these issues this afternoon. He was raised in Pincher Creek and was a graduate of Matthew Halton High School, did his undergraduate studies at the University of Lethbridge, and graduated from the University of Victoria with a law degree in 1998. Scott's been in sole private practice for 6 years, specializing in litigation and working extensively for property owners who oppose oil and gas power expansions through homesteads and prime agricultural land. Scott recently won a landmark appeal preventing a $2 billion project from Calgary to Edmonton proposed by AltaLink. And at the November EUB hearings in Lethbridge, Scott represented 24 property owners opposing the MATL application. So I'd call on Scott now to come forward to the podium and fill us in.
Well, so I asked for an easel, but I failed to ask for something to put upon the easel to write on, so it occurs to me, so that I don't offend my generous host, that I'll put it to some kind of a use, and that's a little bit hot in here anyways. I was sitting last evening between all the things that have happened in the past year or two, especially the last 6 months, between the 500 kV line that my host was kind enough to mention, the Bill C-46, which for us, sadly, was just passed during a marathon session of the legislature, and then also the MATL line. I could easily probably fill a multi-day lecture series. I don't know how much I'm going to be able to hit in a half an hour. What I did was I jotted down a few high points. I'll just go ahead and talk rather haphazardly for about half an hour. If someone can put their hand up when I'm at 25 minutes, and I'll try to give everybody their $10 worth, and hopefully with some of the questions we'll fill in some of the gaps. Now, I think the first thing I want to address, just by way of background, essentially what this project is for anybody who's not familiar with it, what they're proposing to do is to string a line just a little bit east of town through the ready-made area down by Milk River and then down to Great Falls. And what this will do is it'll link the Alberta integrated electric system with some of the American system. Now, as my host mentioned, one of the issues is, of course, power export to the U.S. Now, as things currently stand, probably partly because somebody stopped AltaLink from building a 500 kV line, as it stands right now, most of what's arranged is actually for wind power that's in Montana will be contracted and will probably flow up here, or at least so they tell us. The access to the engineering information that we have is that as things stand right now, given the status of our electric system in this area, that this line is really not going to, it's not really going to add anything in any real material way right now at all. It's not going to make us more reliable. It's not going to make us less reliable. It's not really going to do a lot of anything. Eventually, there will be the ties required to get power down here and so on and so forth. And we're pretty certain that eventually, yes, it will be something that will ship power down to the U.S. One of the things that's been very interesting to us is we came into possession of a report. I think it was about 2002 or 2003. It was a California study group that was looking at ways to try to get more power down to around that whole Los Angeles area in order to supply their just ever-increasing energy demand. They're almost in a crisis type of a situation there. And so their study group down in California was looking at different ways of doing that. When we reviewed that report, one of the things that was interesting to us is that the American study group, the California study group that was looking at ways of doing this, a lot of their sketches and lines as far as different ways to get power down to that Los Angeles area just very curiously seem to match that 500 kV project from Calgary to Edmonton and this MATL line. And so that's one of the things that we question greatly is, in the end, really who is this for the benefit of? A few of the things that I think are concerns, another group that we kind of carved off from ours at the hearing was trying to address the idea of upstream impacts. Okay, this is a line that's been promoted as something that's going to help wind power. Now, one of the things that's curious is initially when it was promoted as helping wind power, it was promoted in the sense that we're going to have all of these southern Alberta wind farms that are going to come online, and we're going to hook up power with them, and it's going to make it more reliable, and maybe we can ship some wind power down to the U.S. It turns out, of course, that, I mean, that's not the case. The wind power that's being developed is in Montana. So as time progresses and there's more links and more power can come down to this area, one of the questions is, what's the global impact of this project? What are all of the upstream impacts? And a group that we have had some dealings with that attempted to intervene in the EUB proceedings was in fact very concerned that what's going to happen is this is going to work its way up the line, and there is this insatiable demand for electricity in Southern California. And what's going to the inevitable result is going to be that in the end, we're going to have a demand for, in fact, more dirty power and more cheap coal-fired power that's going to be generated in the central Alberta area. I think what a lot of the concerns have to center around is the issue of, is this line needed? And also the issue as far as the line is a private, for-profit, merchant line. One of the first of its kind. I believe going internationally, it is, I think, the first of its kind. And that is really a lot of the crux of the issue. The people that I represent are not unreasonable. They understand that we need that in some situations we need facilities. We need certain things to be there. An analogy that I use a lot of the time is I say, well, you know, if you live in a small community and the mayor says, we're going to need a water tower, and it's going to be for the benefit of the entire community, and you're going to indirectly benefit, and we've got to find the best site for it. Sorry, that site's in your backyard. Well, nobody's really happy about having a water tower in their backyard, but if it has to be there, if you need it, town's going to die of thirst if you don't have it, and there's going to be a community benefit locally and an indirect benefit to you, well, you suck it up and you take one for the team. It's a completely different matter if you say, we're going to put a water tower in your backyard, and then we're going to sell the water to a neighboring community, or we're going to sell the water someplace else, and there is going to be no benefit to you. And that is really the situation that we're in. There were a variety of things initially promoting reliability. Even some reports, some landowners being told they could get power off the line, which is not the case. Some landowners being told that they could sell power to the line if they generated it by solar or wind on their land, which is not the case. The sole way that this line is going to be able to be used is to sell power between the two jurisdictions, which provides a financial benefit to the shareholders of MATL. Now, the problem is there are a whole bunch of difficulties that a power line strung through this area causes. If we were in a situation, for example, when the 500 kV line further north was proposed, they said, it hasn't turned out to be the case, but they said at the time that if we don't build this, lights are going to start going out in Calgary. Well, that's a need. That's an actual need, okay? What MATL has tried to say is they've said, well, there's a need because the market will use it. We've contracted for the capacity. The free market's going to use it, so there's a need for it. And we project at some future point down the road the power might be necessary. Well, what the need issue came down to us was essentially an argument before the Energy Utilities Board that, listen, you have to do two things as far as the need is concerned. What the legislation has done in privatizing this is it's enabled these private firms to do this and to make these type of proposals, but what our position has been is that the law is that, firstly, you do need to show that there's going to be some contracted capacity for it and that the line is needed in that sense, in an economic sense, that the market will bear it, but there is a second part of that, and you do have to show that it's actually necessary. Necessary in the sense that if we don't have this line, that there's going to be some negative consequence for us. We're not going to have enough power. And they simply haven't been able to do that. Now, one of the things I think that proponents of the line have said is, well, it's a free market. If the line wasn't necessary, people wouldn't contract for the capacity, it wouldn't fly. The free market will take care of it. The thing is, though, is when you're dealing with something like large utilities, traditionally, we don't use the free market exclusively to do that. There's a lot of reasons for that. I'll use one example. When we privatized liquor stores in Alberta a number of years ago, everyone can remember that after they did that, I mean, how many liquor stores were there in town? 50? Right after that, almost the week after that. And hey, the free market will take care of it. There's only room for so many. The best ones will stay. The worst ones won't. In that type of a situation, hey, you don't need to go and apply for a, you don't need to go and have a hearing in front of a board to decide if you want to open a liquor store, if you want to put your money into it, get your necessary liquor permit and do it. If the market won't bear it, you bear the consequences. And you can deal with that failure quite easily. The building can be leased out again. The stock can be resold. The employees will go work someplace else. Okay. Now, with a power line, it's a little bit different. You can't start knitting an afghan of power lines across the country because you say, look, if there's no need for it, people won't buy the capacity. What's the harm? Well, you're left with the power line afterwards. And so one of the things that we maintain is you have to – the Alberta government, rightly or wrongly, has decided that private enterprise can make a buck off of these things. But we say you still have to show that it's necessary. Okay? Now – why would farmers be concerned about this type of a project? Well, one of the things that was a recurring theme over the course of the EUB hearing was the chairman repeatedly asking the council for MATL, look, you have a private enterprise on one hand, a power company, that wants to make money, that to do so needs to encroach on the private enterprise of another private party. What it is it's tantamount to me saying I would like to open a store. And to do that, I would like to go on your land or your front yard in order to open that store. That's essentially the same thing. They have to enter onto private property or encroach on private property. And there are a whole bunch of things that a power line will do to a private landowner. Some of the things that we raised on the hearing, at the hearing, and it goes, I think, back. What the unifying theme was to us was that essentially this project took as straight a line as possible between the substation east of town that they proposed and the substation by Great Falls that they proposed. They made some attempts at public consultation but never really did a lot as far as changing their route. And one of the things that we maintained as a private enterprise that it was under bankrolled and that the unifying thing was that they were trying to find the cheapest way that they could to possibly do this. And so one of the things to make the straightest line possible, which costs the least money in the short term, was to basically do a straight line down just east of town, which goes through some of the most heavily irrigated land in the province. Why is that a problem? Well, what happens is when you go through irrigated land, you end up in kind of a catch-22 situation with irrigation and aerial spraying. Irrigation pivots need to make a full circuit in order to irrigate effectively. If there's an obstruction in the middle of the path of travel of an irrigation pivot, and whether that obstruction is physical in the sense that there's a pole in the way and the pivot can't make a full circuit, or that pivot or that obstruction is notional in the sense that you have to stay a certain distance back from the power line because the water has to be a certain distance away from that conductor in order to avoid a problem. So either way, if the pivot can't complete a full rotation, well, you can really only do two things. You can shorten the pivot. Unfortunately, what happens there is when you shorten the pivot, then in order to avoid that obstruction, you now have that carryover of that extra pivot arm length all around the rest of the field that you can't irrigate. One of the things, as I went back to, I think, about grade 7 math and the formula for an area of the circle, is the amount of coverage that you get from that pivot is disproportionate on the outside of the pivot. In other words, the last 10 meters of that pivot on the end arm of the pivot irrigates a lot more land than the first 10 meters. So you lose a lot more than what you think. Okay. The second thing that you can do is you can windshield wipe. You can go up to your obstruction, then you can reverse and you can turn around and go back. Well, when you do that again, there's a whole host of problems depending on what you're farming. You have pivot tracks that you create that are deeper than normal. You also end up in a situation where you are going over one area, you've just watered it, there, so you're watering twice really quickly one area, and then you have the area back on the other end, which now has a long time between the watering. And so that's also not a very good situation. Now, what can you do about that? Well, one of the things MATL proposed to do was you can make the conductor higher. Here's the problem with this. A lot of the areas that are irrigated grow such dense and high-value crops that the threshold for spraying the economic threshold for spraying is usually met. A lot of the places have to aerial spray. They're so wet, and the nature of the crop that they're growing is such that ground spraying is just not practical. The higher you raise the conductor, the more difficult the aerial spraying is. I'll pass this around, and what you can see is you can see an aerial spray plane, just exactly how low that they have to get. And so what happens is these planes fly at about 180 miles an hour. They have to clear that conductor by a safety distance. Then they drop down into a steep dive, and they have to get that distance off of the ground and start their spray. So because a plane can't go like this, okay, as you're doing that angle downwards, you have the higher you make that conductor, you know, you apply the Pythagorean theorem or whatever, the more area you miss at the bottom that you can't spray. In some situations, you can do a dress-up spray by going around at the end and spraying that front area that you miss on the beginnings of those first passes. Problem is, in a lot of the lands that we're going across here, there's already existing power lines. And this power line, in a lot of cases, completes a box on the property, and it's just not possible. So then, you have a situation where you have high-value crops, you have risk of disease, you have a loss in areas that can't be sprayed or alternatively can't be irrigated. If they are irrigated but not sprayed, you have a risk and a breeding ground for disease that can damage and can take an entire crop. And so it's something that certainly the farmers don't take lightly. Those that are further south that don't irrigate an aerial spray and grow lower value crops, essentially what it leaves them with is you have to slalom your equipment around these poles. And it's just another one of those things that a farmer just doesn't need. I think I said it once before that, and probably offended all of my landowner clients when I referred to farming as glorified lawn mowing. But in a sense, being a town kid when I was young, the closest thing that I could recognize to it was mowing my front yard versus mowing my backyard. They were both about the same area. The backyard had a fireplace in the middle. It took longer to mow the backyard. It's tougher to make circles and make repeat passes. It costs extra time. I mean, it was that much longer that I could get back in to watch the TV. But if you're a farmer doing it on a larger scale, that means money, and that means loss. And there are limitations. Yes, there is a structure in place in terms of compensations, but there are some severe limitations to it, and it is on the farmer to go then and try to get their compensation. It has been my experience at companies, when they're applying for a permit, are always a lot more liberal in terms of talking about what they're going to compensate, yeah, and what they're going to make up for. And then suddenly at the surface rights board stage of the game, things are a little bit different. We found as we got further into this that the approach of this company was just... I remember one individual described as trying to hit a moving target. They didn't really have down in a lot of firm way even what exactly it was that they were going to do, exactly what materials they were going to use, exactly where poles were going to be placed and these type of things. So we, in fact, went to a hearing where the company's position was basically, well, we're going to put a line through this rough area. We can't tell you exactly where the poles are going to go, but we're going to try to work on for landowners and or with landowners and make this as easy on them as possible. So a company is applying for a permit for permission that's going to eventually allow them to enter on private land, and they don't actually firmly know where the poles and where the structure is going to go. And you know, we showed them pictures of pivots that were the end guns were almost touching on adjacent quarters as they were going around. And you know, how do you propose to deal with that? Well, we think we can deal with it. We don't have a firm plan to deal with it right now, but I think if landowners can work with us, we think we can deal with it. And so that's the type of thing that we were facing. They found out later on that when they were going through the Warner area, they in fact had their line plotted right on top of about 7 miles of Warner Water Co-op line, right on top of it. So just absolutely unbelievable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we could, when I gave my final, I see my two clients at the back that came today are kind of grinning. When I gave my final submission about this stuff, I went on for 2.5 hours. So I'm going to call it there. One of the other concerns we have, and it was something that was fairly hotly debated, is EMF. And what EMF is it's the electromagnetic fields that are given off by a transmission line. Okay, it's something that there's a lot of dispute and a lot of debate in the science right now. Mattel called an expert to say they're no hazard at all. I'd live under a power line. I have no problem with it. What we did is we flew up a gentleman who was about 75 years old, a guy by the name of Dr. Milham, who was essentially responsible for starting the EMF debate back just about 30 years ago. And a gentleman who had conducted many, many studies in EMF, many, many studies in, I think, over 100 studies in epidemiology, studying human disease and effects of environmental factors on humans, and gave what we felt was some pretty convincing evidence that there is some risk as to what these things give off and what they do to people. The IARC, one of the cancer regulatory bodies, has in fact, which is fairly conservative as far as what it defines and what it doesn't. Anyways, we presented some evidence that we feel there is a great deal of problems with the EMFs. A lot of the other stuff that we talked about, and people can ask me questions about this, dealt with the tactics that were used by landowners, used against landowners by the company. Divide and conquer, just a level of, just a type of strategy and a level of respect that we just found completely and totally unacceptable, even in comparison with the conduct of other utility companies, was just way below par. One of the things that has been interesting since is, of course, now Bill 46 has been enacted. Bill 46 has now put us in a situation where it is questionable, with hearings of these kind in the future, in what circumstances and how protected our right to get a hearing and even be involved, thank you, sir, our ability to get a hearing and be involved, how protected that even is. Under the old legislation, the hearing was a right. Now the hearing is to be heard from by, I think now what they call it, the Electric Commission or something like that. It's not the EUB anymore. It's essentially been reduced to a privilege. There's provisions that if a company can convince the ASO that something is urgent enough, they can proceed as if notice had been given. All kinds of things that we just find in a democratic country extremely scary. One of the things that we left off on the hearing, this because it was international, involved the National Energy Board, there was some interesting things as far as the interacting jurisdictions. One of the things that Mattel relied on from the beginning was that they satisfied the National Energy Board that they had a 2-kilometer-wide corridor that they were granted to run this line within. And all of these things that we raised as far as farming and irrigation, what Mattel basically did was they said, we're limited to the 2-kilometer corridor. So we only have to find the best route within that 2-kilometer pathway. You can't argue about the stuff outside of the pathway. We, of course, dispute that hotly because we, in fact, hired a consultant who didn't take 2 years, took maybe a week, hopped in a pickup truck, took a little drive, and found a route that impacted, what, a third as much irrigation, less houses. We found that when we analyzed the approach that Mattel had used, I kid you not, in their corridor selection, they gave more weight and assigned greater weighting factors to ducks. And I have nothing wrong with ducks. There's no problem with ducks. But I do believe that humans count more than ducks. They assign more weight to ducks than proximity to houses, which had no weighting factor at all, and more priority to ducks than to irrigation. All agriculture was lumped in as one, irrigated or non-irrigated. And those were things that gave us, raised some pretty big questions in our mind.
Thank you, Scott. We will break for lunch now. We'll come back in about half an hour, and there will be questions. And obviously, Scott has a lot more to impart, in part, so we'll have lots of questions.